Good afternoon.
I'm Al Cresta. Thanking you for being here. We're talking last segment about the PBS series, The Great War, 3 episodes. I recommend you see it, but what I'm frustrated by is what I'm often frustrated by, and that is that many people in our among our cultural elite, our opinion makers, our storytellers, simply don't understand the spiritual dynamics underlying these great events. Look, World War I took place in a Christian civilization. You have to just admit that Christianity profoundly influenced these cultures. These were putatively, that is in name, Christian nations. England, France, Germany, Russia, Italy. So we shouldn't fool ourselves here. And Christianity had tremendous cultural clout at the time. And yet, we had this war in 1914 through 1918. I think doing apologetics doesn't mean whitewashing the sins of the faithful. Where the church or where Christian communities have failed, we have to be willing to acknowledge that. And for all the positive things that Christendom achieved, and they are remarkable, the rise of the university, the abolition of slavery, the elevation of women, you can go down the list, the rise of free market, the ability to do to operate an economy with free markets, consent to the governed, all of these achievements have their roots in various aspects of the gospel and in the proclamation of the church. Nevertheless, World War I is a basic judgment on the failure of the Christendom of that period. They were unable to reconcile. They had not learned the lessons by which they could reconcile the conflict of these nations. Now, my guest, Phil Jenkins, coming up in a few minutes, points out in his book, The Great and Holy War, How World War I Became a Religious Crusade, he says that, look, at the end of 1918, at the close of the war, Western nations had to face up to two extremely difficult questions. One, what does a nation do after it has lost a war that it identified as a holy war? And another question, which is just as difficult, what does a country do after it has won such a conflict? So here you have a holy war, you win it, what do you do? Here you have a holy war, you lose it, what do you do? And Europe and the Middle East were plunged into a pool of sacrificial blood, and yet the old injustices were stubbornly in place. There was a new world now of hunger, a new world of poverty. And many people thought that as early as 1920, that this was not a settled issue. There was going to be more war to come. So Phil Jenkins, I caught up with him on the 100th anniversary of World War I at the Napa Institute. And I asked him to just explain to me a little bit of how the Christian faith played into this, quote, great and holy war, World War I. I wanted to share that interview with you. Joining me right now, Dr. Philip Jenkins. He was educated at Cambridge University from 1980 through 2011. He taught at Penn State, where he holds the rank of Emeritus Edwin Earl Sparks Professor of Humanities. In 2012, he became a distinguished professor of history at Baylor University, where he serves in the Institute for Studies of Religion. He's the author of 25 books, including The Next Christendom, The Coming of Global Christianity, The Lost History of Christianity, and most recently, The Great and Holy War, How World War I Became a Religious Crusade. Philip, nice to have you with me. Thank you.
Very good to see you again.
Well, this summer marks 100 years since the guns of August 1914 signaled World War I, the beginning of World War I. Most of us, when we hear World War I referred to, have gotten the message that it was a futile war, extraordinary loss of life, unclear wins. You know all that, and you write about all that, but you're also very aware of the religious dimension of the war, how the religious issues that started it and the religious consequences that flowed from it. Can you set up what the Holy Alliance was and how these nations related to one another at the very beginning?
Sure. In a lot of ways, I do not see it as a futile war in terms of the what I would regard as a mythology. It was very much like the Second World War in the sense that it was fought to prevent one nation, one empire, which was Germany, establishing a European empire and ultimately a world empire. And in many ways, the Germany of the First World War foreshadows the Germany of the Second World War. So morally, I think there's a lot of
continuity. So you draw
the
real parallels. Do you see World War II as just an extension of World War I interrupted by an armistice?
Yeah, very much. In fact, there's a famous story where the German general who took Paris in 1940 was asked by a journalist how long his lightning campaign had taken, and he replied, 26 years. In other words, from 1914 to 1940. Very, very strong continuity. So I argue against this idea of futility. The reason I talk so much about religion is what I suggest is that this is a generation which is inconceivably religious by the standards of the modern world, whether you're dealing with Christians or Jews or Muslims. Religion matters enormously, and so do really apocalyptic and supernatural ideas. So my basic argument is that if you don't understand the religious dimensions of the war, you don't understand the reasons why people go to war, why they stay at war, and why the war is interpreted in particular ways, particular rhetoric, that it is. And that religious heritage would have a lot of aftermath after 1918. But that's a very quick summary of what I'm arguing.
Well, given that the European nations were all essentially Christian, and you also had the Ottoman Empire, which was Muslim, was there any attempt to say, we are Christians, we are one body, we should not be going to war against one another?
There certainly is, and there's one person who stands out overwhelmingly in this, and that's Pope Benedict XV, and he actually says everything you would have expected a Christian statesman to have said. He wants peace, and in fact, there's something we forget, he comes up with very, very practical suggestions and proposals for bringing the war to an end in 1917, which actually come quite close to providing a settlement. He fails, but he tries his absolute best. Much more common is the religious setting in establishment in each individual country, whether it's a Protestant, Catholic, and they use traditional Christian ideas, rhetoric, imagery, entirely for what you can only call a holy war ideology, that each country is fighting to create the kingdom of God. Each country is using images of sacrificial blood for the creation of justice. And part of that is, even if you are fighting a Christian country, then you have to deny the Christianity of that country.
Yeah.
They may seem to be Christian, but they are really some kind of pagan force. And in many ways, it looks like what we think of today as the kind of jihad theories that you come from radical Muslim countries, which is very disturbing.
Yeah, indeed. Pope Benedict XV tried to be an honest broker for peace. How was he regarded by the principals in the war?
The problem was, he suggested a simple solution in 1917, which is everyone should go back to where they started from, that the countries should disarm and they should use the money that they saved for social improvement. Anything that they had in terms of disagreements, they should just refer to arbitration. It seems so sane, so sensible. The problem was that each individual country believed that it had shed so much blood by that point that they weren't just going to give up. And they also thought, rightly or wrongly, that with one more push, they could get everything they ever wanted. So it was a great example of human nature and original sin. They weren't prepared to listen to reason. But at that point, there's absolutely no doubt Benedict was the voice of reason.
Clergy at that time, it's troubling to me, as I listen to you, to think
that they were using the language of ultimacy in the pulpit. They were demonizing the opposition, and they were angelizing themselves, something which is always dangerous, especially when it comes to political and certainly military activity. What happened to the tradition of Protestant liberalism at that time? Growing out of Germany. I just have a hard time understanding how they could, especially the scholars who had cooperated together prior to the war, churchmen and scholars, could begin to regard these same people as participants in the Whore of Babylon.
Right. Well, you know, it's important that you mentioned the idea of these liberals, particularly liberal Protestants, because as the war works out, it's usually these people who before the war had been the main liberal Protestants, very often the exponents of a social gospel, who are the most determined to speak in terms of crusade and holy war, the most determined to demonize the enemy. That was particularly true in the United States. And when the U.S. joined the war in 1917, the language they used was so extreme, by modern standards, so hysterical, in terms of crusade, holy war, the evils of the enemy. One of America's most prominent Protestant preachers openly advocated the genocide of the German people. In the German case, the great liberal Protestant figure of the age was Adolf von Harnack, who basically wrote much of the imperial propaganda, who drafted and signed some very extreme statements of German militarism in 1914, which would actually have a long aftermath, because it was the reaction against these statements by von Harnack and others that led theologians like Karl Barth to reject the alliance of church and state and seek for wholly new grounds for the basis of their Christian allegiance. And that would become neo-orthodoxy, Karl Barth, Paul Tillich, and so on. Mm-hmm. But that was an aftermath of the really complete sellout of liberal Protestants to imperialism and militarism.
My guest is Dr. Philip Jenkins, talking about his most recent work, called The Great and Holy War, How World War I Became a Religious Crusade. We're coming back on the other side of the break, continuing the conversation. I'm Al Cresta. I'm Al Cresta, talking with Dr. Philip Jenkins, who's remembering the religious passions that set the world ablaze a century ago. Remember, it was August of 1914 that the guns of Europe begin World War I, and we're taking a look at his work in The Great and Holy War, How World War I Became a Religious Crusade. Let's talk a little bit about the consequences of the war. I've always thought of World War I as a way that European Christianity, the way Europe became de-Christianized, the consequences of the war, of these nations using religious language, using their state churches to battle other Christians using the language of ultimacy, that subsequent to the war, people were dispirited, they were cynical, and Christianity took quite a blow in Europe at that time. Is that true?
Well, what I would argue is this. All the way through the war, it's not just from states. Ordinary people seem to have these extremely religious, apocalyptic ideas. You could actually rewrite the story of the war in terms of a belief in angels and apparitions and visions, which seem to be very widely credited. And, you know, perhaps we can talk about that. There is really a myth that at the end of the war, you get this great religious disenchantment. There's a scholar called Jonathan Ebel, and he says that what you get in 1918 is re-enchantment, that there's a resurgence of religion,
really?
Partly as a result of the enormous religious feeling that people have lived in. You know, for one thing, the churches have got an excellent reputation for what they've done through the war, that they have so many other activities and responsibilities through looking after the cult of remembrance, the all these ceremonies remembering the war dead. And it's not until the 1930s that you really get a reaction setting in against the war. The other thing is, if you look at Europe, Europe secularizes, of course, but it does not secularize at least until the late 50s, early 60s, 40 or more years after World War I. So if there is a reaction, it is a very delayed reaction. What you do see, however, think about it. If you've lived in this world where you believe you're fighting a holy war, you believe you're fighting a crusade, and suddenly the war ends and you've lost.
Right.
How do you explain that? And there are a couple of reasons. One is to say, well, we weren't taking account of God's enemies within. And in Germany, for example, that's at the point at which people turned to scapegoating internal enemies, above all Jews, who prevented the holy war being fought. And that's one result. The two countries which have the most messianic visions of themselves in 1914 are Germany and Russia, which, of course, by the 1930s, are still leading these very apocalyptic movements in secularized terms, communism and Nazism.
That's interesting.
I would suggest that we should see those as religious visions in secularized form. And certainly these very religious, apocalyptic languages, they're bringing in the final battle, they're bringing in the great final day. Very religious, very apocalyptic.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So what you have are these, in a sense, secular religions in Nazism and communism,
exactly,
which filled the void that had been left by the war and Christianity. I'm curious, too, about these apparitions. Talk to me about that. Where did these take place? What traditions were they most common within? Did they gain national support, or did they remain kind of regional cults?
They went beyond national, and they became global. The most famous example of all, but it's just one of many, in 1914, the British won a battle at Mons on the Western Front. A Welsh fantasy writer called Arthur Machen wrote a story in which he imagined the British soldiers being rescued by the ghosts of medieval bowmen who rose from the dead and fought on their side. And it was a fantasy story. Within weeks, Machen was meeting people who claimed to have been at the battle. They'd seen the bowmen. And this seems silly, but within a few months, this became a global phenomenon of the Angel of Mons, the angels that appeared in the front line to fight for the British soldiers. And throughout the war, every country, Protestant, Catholic, Orthodox, sees angels. It sees angels in its numbers. And we think these days, we think of angels in terms of maybe, Hallmark, cute little angels.
Yeah, yeah.
These are not those angels. These are the mighty angels of the Book of Revelation, culminating in 1917 when the Archangel Michael appears to usher in the vision of Fatima. Germany, through the war, has this great belief in something that becomes almost a national war god, which is the Archangel Michael. When the Germans fight their mighty offensive on the Western Front in 1918, of course it's called Operation Michael. Wherever you turn, you get angels and apparitions, and that concentrates in the great apocalyptic year of the war in 1917, when the British take Jerusalem from the Turks in what media around the world describe as the culmination of the Crusades. Every church in Rome sings a Te Deum to celebrate the event, and the excitement about that carries on until the end of 1918, when the British general in the Holy Land wins his greatest victory over the Turks at, where else? Megiddo, wow. The field of Armageddon.
Wow. Wow. How did the Ottoman Turks respond to this?
Well, from 1915, of course, they're facing this nightmare scenario where their country is about to be destroyed. And they respond to that by launching a ferocious, bitter persecution against the Christians, who they see as their internal enemies. And it's in 1915 that they launch a genocide against the Armenians and other Christian groups like the Assyrians. They probably kill 1.5 million Armenians. They probably kill 1/3 of the Assyrian population, who are the people we today think of suffering under ISIS and the caliphate in Iraq. They kill millions of Christians, and that, in a sense, is their particular apocalypse. And there is a direct inheritance from that to the genocide of Jews in the 1940s. In 1939, as Hitler is going to war, he's briefing his generals, and of course the question he asks them is, who today remembers the Armenians?
Now, after the war, I want to make sure I understand. So after the war, immediately in Europe, there is religious renewal?
There is a sort of religious renewal, yes, and particularly in Catholic Europe, where the Catholic Church rides very high. It has a huge amount of prestige.
Okay. Now, what happens outside of Europe? You've got Africa, where there's been a lot of colonization. Is this when decolonization begins?
Not decolonization, but the First World War was absolutely critical for Africa. It means that European missions are cut off, so it means that African churches have to be independent. But also, as there are disasters and war and plague raging all over Europe, it means that people turn to religious responses. And this is the point at which we get a phenomenal upsurge across Africa of prophets, of religious leaders, revivals, all of which are native black African movements, not European. During the 20th century, some people would say the most important thing that happened to the Christian church was the explosion of Christianity in Africa. Yeah. And you can date it very, very precisely to the First World War. The great movement that drives it is the great flu epidemic, which kills tens of millions in 1918. And in Africa, the response to that is the upsurge of healing movements that today are actually global churches. So when you write the history of Christianity in Africa, it has to begin with the First World War.
So this black leadership, this indigenous leadership, they were out of the Christian tradition, these prophets. They weren't animistic religions.
No, very much. These are Christian movements. Up until the First World War, you have mainly white mission-led churches with African followers. It is in the First World War that African Christians emerge, take the lead, form their own churches, become their own prophets. And when we look at some of the great African global churches today, look at their roots, and they'll always go back to 1918.
Wow, absolutely fascinating. How was Christianity changed in America as a result of the First World War? Yeah, Billy Sunday was the leading Protestant evangelist of the period, I think.
Yeah. He was a very determined exponent of holy war, of crusade, of militarism. One of the great phenomena was a great explosion of Pentecostalism. The Pentecostal movement was very new. It was founded in 1906. Around about 1912, you got a religious revival emerging with its great hymns, like the Old Rugged Cross and In the Garden. But it's during the First World War that these visions go national. It's during the First World War, for example, that the Protestants succeed in getting a prohibition amendment passed. It doesn't take effect until 1919. And so you get a great expansion of Pentecostal fundamentalist ideas. Interestingly, the phrase the Bible Belt dates from 1918.
Oh, I didn't realize that. We've only got about a minute and a half, but I want to have you talk about the Ottoman Empire, which was called the sick man of Europe. In 1924, there's the abolition of the caliphate. What's World War I's impact on the Ottoman Empire?
Boy, its impact on the empire and on the much wider Muslim world. You mentioned the end of the caliphate, crucial moment in Islamic history. This is an institution founded in the year 631. It's on the verge of celebrating its 1300th anniversary, doesn't quite make it. But the fact of losing the caliphate revolutionizes Islam worldwide. People struggle to adapt to this world. Through the 1920s, jihads, holy wars, rebellions rage across the whole Islamic world, Africa, Asia. And most of the movements that we know today are a direct outcome of the movement that grows from the collapse of the caliphate. The Muslim Brotherhood that we hear of in the context of Egypt is formed in 1928, for example. So there's a direct continuity from the First World War to the Islamic world as we know it today.
Oh. Is the restoration of the caliphate plausible in your analysis?
I would say not. In some ways, it just attracts so much opposition. And what I would always remind anyone who's interested, that if we look at the original caliphate in the 7th century, three of the first four incumbents were assassinated. So it's not actually a great precedent.
Phil, thank you so much.
Well, thank you
great
so
talking.
Much.
Dr. Philip Jenkins, his most recent book deals with the First World War. It's called The Great and Holy War, How World War I Became a Religious Crusade. I'm Al Creston.